Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Ophir Drouri. He's the founder of LAGA, the Last Great Ape Organization, an enforcement non-governmental organization that fights corruption in order to bring about the arrests and prosecutions of major wildlife criminals dealing in endangered animal species. LAGA's award-winning model for a wildlife law enforcement NGO started in Cameroon and is now replicated in the Republic of the Congo, the Central African Republic, and Gabon. In 2005, on the experience of fighting corruption in the judiciary and the forces of law and order, he has founded another NGO called Anti-Corruption in Cameroon, or AC Cameroon, which focuses on establishing anti-corruption law enforcement in that country and involving citizens in the fight against corruption through direct legal action. He's a co-founder of the Eagle Network, which is leading the fight against wildlife crime and, with more than 2,000 significant wildlife traffickers jailed to date, fighting corruption to break complicity and ensure justice. He's won numerous awards for his work, including the World Wildlife Fund Duke of Edinburgh Conservation Medal. So first off, thank you for your extraordinary work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Glad to be here.
So can you talk first about, I guess, define trafficking in wildlife and then talk about the scale of it and the harm it causes?
Sure. Well, I mean, people don't really understand it, but illegal wildlife trafficking, illegal wildlife trade, is the fifth largest illegal trade in the world. It fetches a lot of money, unfortunately. So, you know, we know a little bit about the ivory trade. That is something that is known, but there's also illegal trade in lions and leopards for their skins as trophies. There is also illegal trade in some of the birds that we can see as pets, one here and one there. We don't really understand that we are talking about 1,000 of parrots, half of them dying on the way in a shipment somewhere from Africa to supply this market. There are magnificent creatures called pangolin. They're sort of ant bears, for those who don't know what pangolins are. And their scales worth a lot of money. Their body is scaled. They are mammals, and their scales are fetching a lot of money in Asia, in China, and Vietnam, and they are really featuring in the illegal trade. And each time we see more and more animals that we don't expect to be killed for anything, really, really entering into this kind of industry of the illegal trade, and therefore they are disseminated really fast, and that leads us to a race towards extinction of many of those animals. This is the illegal trade in wildlife trafficking we're talking about, and most of it is organized crime, very well organized, many times connected to other forms of crime like drug trade, like arms trade, and others. These kind of mafia organizations undertake this trafficking. They are good at it, far better than anyone else, and they are accelerating the race towards extinction of these animals.
So it seemed to me that the story of how you got started in fighting this was an example of some of the problems you faced with the corruption. I'm thinking of that first baby chimpanzee. Do you want to briefly tell that story?
Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, that's the source of my passion to this fight. I was an adventurer crisscrossing the continent, the African continent, looking for adventure and trying to find wisdom and tap into those ancient ways and learn more from tribes that were living in isolated areas, different cultures that still survived. And it turned me into an activist, just trying to give back to this continent that gave me so much. And therefore, as an activist, I was just trying to do my best, moving from country to country, just trying to do something good. And so I was developing different skills as a part of that. And at that time, I was trying to write about human rights in Nigeria. It got a bit risky. And I crossed into Cameroon, basically to take it easy. And I was thinking, one good thing I can do with my time is write about the extinction of apes. The illegal trade in apes' meat was leading to their extinction. And I had in my mind a sentence from Jane Goodall that said that in 20 years from now, we're going to lose gorillas and chimps for the illegal trade in their meat, what is called bush meat. And basically the meat of chimps and gorillas is considered a sort of exclusive, basically sort of like a caviar, if you'd like, of the jungles of Africa, of Central Africa, where these animals live. And so I crossed into Cameroon. I started writing about this problem. This is what I thought I would have a meaningful interaction with. And it was pretty easy. I volunteered in a sanctuary of apes and spent time with us, with the chimps, and realizing how much they are like us, how much they are sensitive, how unique these animals are, so close to being human, with such an emotional world, social world, that really makes you wonder about our differences between the animal kingdom and ourselves, and how we usually perceive to be so far away from it. And the chimps are kind of challenging that. And then I went out and I was trying to go into the markets and trying to look at the illegal trade. And I saw that actually there were ape parts being sold, ape hands and ape bodies and so on. And it was sold by the same police officers and same wildlife officers that were entrusted to protect those animals in the first place. So the corruption was really out there. And I joined a checkpoint and I wrote about that. And I saw how in the checkpoint, cars were stopped. And when they were seizing ape meat, they were just reselling it back to the traffickers. So everything was, corruption was really undermining the application of the law. And there was a law in Cameroon that gave up to 3 years imprisonment to anybody even touching a chimp. But I was asking the question, you know, if everything is over there corruption, the same enforcers of laws are those that are running the illegal trade to start with, then how many times was this law applied for almost a decade in which it was in place? And the answer was zero. It was never applied. Zero wildlife prosecutions, zero arrests of wildlife traffickers. Now, that isn't surprising when you look at the corruption that undermines the enforcement system and the judicial system. And therefore, I had, you know, after 2 or 3 weeks, I already had, let's say, 80% of a 20-page article that I wanted to write and you know, kind of like message that this problem to the world, and it was very clear. It was chimps and gorillas are so much like us, and they are endangered, and they are racing towards extinction. And it is because there is illegal trade in their meat, and because there is corruption, and the law is never applied, and therefore we are in a far deeper problem. And so I was looking for the light in the end of the tunnel of this article and of my stay there. And my idea was to write this article and to direct the public to those who are fighting against this kind of prophecy of Jane Goodall, this dark prophecy that in 20 years they'll disappear. You know, those activists in the field that are going to, that are fighting against all odds and trying to direct the public to say, please help them. And that's how you're going to have something meaningful out of reading my dark article. So the light in the end of the tunnel is what I was looking for. And therefore, I was going to the NGOs, to the nonprofits, to the conservation world. I was knocking on those doors of the big conservation organizations, knocking on the doors of the international community, environmental programs, and I couldn't get answers. And when finally I got answers, you know, instead of answers, I got huge buildings, huge castles, four driving around, but nothing concrete. And when finally I got answers, these were the answers. The answers were enforcement, that has nothing to do with us. We are just doing seminars and workshops and sometimes buy jeeps to the government, but that's it. We don't touch enforcement. That's not our role. And I was pretty shocked because I was looking for activists and I found maybe the opposite. And continue to dig into it. I was asking about corruption. No nonprofit official even, they were all afraid to even pronounce the word corruption. So I was kind of drowning into a far bigger problem because I thought that conservation was the solution for this problem. And then I realized that conservation was a bigger problem. And this dysfunctional, sometimes corrupt, definitely not directed towards what needs to be fought, and not having that kind of activist approach that I was sure is there for anybody who is trying to fight against all odds to save these animals. And therefore, I left to a small town. I was frustrated. I was kind of stuck in my article. I went out of the capital. 4 hours out into a small town, and I could immediately find people who tell me, here is gorilla meat, and here is where we sell chimp meat, and that's how the trade is going on. And we have also two live ones. And basically the two live ones you are talking about were the survivors of the illegal bushmeat trade, illegal trading in ape meat. And it was basically when a poacher goes and start killing and shooting down a chimp or a gorilla, they would end up killing a family of chimps or gorillas because they protect each other. And if you shoot a mother, well, basically a baby would cling to the mother's body and be completely dependent on her for the first, let's say, 3 years of their lives. So if a poacher kills a mother, the mother falls into the ground, the baby wouldn't run away. He would still be very dependent, like a human baby. So he would cling to the mother and start crying and crying and crying. And the poacher would hold him in the hand and basically decide, maybe I can kill him right now with a machete for the small meat that it has on him. Or maybe I can try my luck in the pet trade. Maybe I can try to sell him as a pet if I can. And in that option, these babies have a little bit time before they end up dead anyway. And I went to the first one. They took me to the first one, which was the two live ones they were talking about. And it was a baby gorilla. And when we reached there, the baby gorilla already died. And that's how gorillas are. They're very sensitive. So even if you'll give that baby gorilla milk and water and everything physical you can give, if you don't give that gorilla, baby gorilla, the love and attention it needs, it will just snap and die. And then I continue to the baby chimp, the other baby they were talking about, and the other live one. And I went there, and there was this baby chimp, and it was 1.5 years old, really tiny. And he was, they were treating him like a rat, poking him with a stick. And he himself was acting like a rat. It's like his emotional world was kind of locked. And that's the way chimps survive, that gorillas can't. And that's why they can stay alive a little bit more. But this one was about to die. He was really sick. And they tried to sell him to me. And of course, I wouldn't do that because I wanted to rescue this baby chimp. But if I would give him the money, they would just go back to the forest and hunt some more, knowing that there is more demand. So I went to the wildlife officers, the wildlife station, and I said, well, look, there is a baby chimp here. We need to rescue him. We need to save him. He can die. There's offenders of the law. You need to apply the law. And they basically told me, well, give us money. And I said, well, listen, you don't understand. There is this baby chimp. There is this. There is the law. The law is on the wall. And here it is, just in a poster written on your wall. You are the ones to apply it. It's your job. And they said, well, what do you give us? So they were totally corrupt. And basically, after half an hour of arguing and trying to persuade them to do their jobs, they were telling me, what's your problem, white man? You want a baby chimp. we will sell you another baby chimp. So basically, those wildlife officers were themselves traffickers. And I couldn't, I went back to my motel and I couldn't sleep that night. I knew I have to save this baby chimp that is just 1.5 years old, can die. But if I save him, can outlive me. So I didn't sleep the whole night. I wrote all my anger on a piece of paper, all my anger from corrupt African governments and from corrupt conservation world and from this ineffectiveness of the entire system, and started writing all my anger and what is wrong in the system and what I was, all that I hated and frustrated about. And in the second half of the night, I started asking myself, well, what did you expect to find? And so I started writing what I thought should be, and that would be an organization based on activism, on local activists, patriots, people who would of the country that would fight to change their country, fighters, not conservation career people, those that would fight corruption, to get these laws that has never been applied, now applied into application. And they would have a kind of organization that would have an investigation unit that would go and have undercover investigators infiltrating those networks and finding not the small poachers, but those police officers I saw, those corrupt ones that were orchestrating everything. And then would have an operations unit, not just give the information to the same corrupt police officers, but basically supervise them and take them by the hand to do their jobs and force them to do it and fight bribing attempts in the field. And then a legal unit that will follow up all these cases in court because the courts are as corrupt as the police officers and the wildlife officers. And so the organization will have to follow up those cases and take responsibility, intercept those corruption attempts, block them, and act as a bodyguard through this whole enforcement and legal systems, and even visit those traffickers in jail to make sure they are still there because they can bribe their way out. And then a media unit that would actually publicize everything and show that the law is applied and create some deterrent for every action that is an enforcement action, advertising that the law is applied. So I wrote this entire thing in the night. And the following morning, I went back there and I said to the wildlife officers, just give me the book of law. I know you're afraid of these guys. Just let me have it and I'll take the baby chimp. And I went to the house of those traffickers that offered me this baby chimp. And I took the book of law and I put it on their table and I said, read it. 3 years imprisonment for anybody even touching a chimp. And they looked at it, and they looked at me, and they were totally unimpressed. So I said, well, look, I know that this, the law, is nothing for you, because this is just a bribe of what, $2-3? I know what it means, but this is exactly my new job. Then I started bluffing them using what I wrote during the night. And I said, I'm a part of this big new organization. And what we do is we fight corruption to get the law applied. And all my job is to make sure you don't bribe your way out of this law. And we contacted the judge and the judge is waiting for you. And well, at this point, they got totally hysterical. And my bluff worked very well. And I did as if I'm calling an imaginary headquarters I say, yes, they are ready. They are cooperative. Tell the judge everything is ready. Yes, there is a car. The car is coming to take you. That's okay. And the bluff worked very well. And at one point, I was just telling them, you know, if you remain my informants, maybe you'll tell me more about those who activate you, those who are hired from you in the illegal trade. Maybe there's something I can do for you. And they were just pleading for me to help them. At this point, of course, they wanted to just get rid of the baby chimp. And I went there to this tiny baby chimp that was tied in the waist. He had wounded in the waist because of the rope in a dirty kitchen. And I untied the baby chimp And everybody thought he would run away because they treated him like a rat and he was acting like a rat. But I knew what was inside him, a baby. So I untied him from his ropes and I held my hands up, stretched it out, and he just climbed my body and gave me one big hug in the chest. And that second, he turned again from a rat back into a baby. And with a full emotional world opening up and needs of a baby. And that was it. You know, that hug was permanent. He chose me basically as his foster mother and father. And from that second, it was impossible to separate us because he was just holding to my body the whole time. And I named him Future because that's what I wanted to give him, a future, this baby chimp. And I went back to the capital thinking still that I would just give my plan that I wrote that night for somebody else to do, give this baby chimp to a sanctuary, and then continue to move from country to country like I done before as an activist. But no sanctuary would take Future, and this baby chose me. And very fast, I realized that I am there to not just give a future to this baby chimp, but trying to fight for the future of his species. And so basically, I would say that Future, the baby chimp, forced me to stay, apply exactly what I wrote that night, and open the first wildlife law enforcement nonprofit in the world at that time. So that's the story, and that's my passion towards this fight.
So one of the reasons that you are one of my heroes is because a lot of people feel bad about things, and a lot of people can have good ideas. But, I mean, I have a friend who is desperately sad because the prairie dogs in Colorado are being wiped out. And Instead of just feeling sad about it, well, she gets up every day and she fights for the prairie dogs. And that movement from just feeling bad about it to actually doing something, I just want to explicitly tell you how much I respect you for that.
Thank you. You know, I mean, I think those who are doing those kind of things, which I would call activists, are not much different from anybody out there. I mean, all of us are angry about something. All of us are frustrated about things we see around us, our communities, our environment, variety of things, environment, out of environment, Africa, US. It doesn't matter, we're all angry. But we, most of us just are able to just, you know, kind of zap to the next station or to the next thought, you know, it's by saying, but here's what is neutralizing that, the action, that, well, I can't do anything. There are some professionals out there, they do that. I'm not able to make a difference. I'm not able to change. And I think the difference between an activist to those who are not yet is just this small difference, small experience of actually trying and seeing how easy it is to make a difference, that anything that you do actually does make a difference. And that's how it was with me, because I was an adventurer and I was moving around, having adventures all across Africa in the most isolated and pristine lands. And I was just trying to give back. And I was surprised in the first times of how easy it was to do something like that. And once you do the first steps, whether it was for me, it was, you know, whether teaching in a school or just helping in a farmland for one of those tribes, into helping in humanitarian operations, into writing, these were all experiences that were just showing me that yes, it is possible. You know, just take your time and you can make a difference. And once you realize that it's possible, this possibility becomes also a responsibility. Your responsibility to participate in a change, participate in shaping your communities and in shaping your environments. And so you know, I'm trying all the time to have that bridge with people and explain that activism for me is a way of life that is so much more fulfilling than those I see around me. And the truth is that it's so easy and it's so obvious. But we keep on having those kind of feeling that no, we can't do that. There's others that can do that. There's other professionals. I'm just a guy. But all these changes are happening because of just guys that just try to do it and realize that they can contribute to a change and to making a difference.
You know, you mentioned pangolins earlier, and a couple of years ago, I interviewed Maria Diekman, who does a lot of work to both stop trafficking and also to in pangolins and also to rehabilitate pangolins. And her mm-hmm. story for how she got started was that she'd read about them and she was complaining to a friend of hers, God, this is just terrible. It's so horrible what's happening to them. And mm-hmm. he just said, well, so do something about it. And there you go. She did. And she's devoted her life to pangolins ever since.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's like that. I mean, if I look back at different fights that we had, whether in wildlife or in human rights or in democracy, you know, none of this was one big win or one big fight. It was all just, you know, small contributions. So some people think that the real difference is that they are not able to change the world. But the truth is that nobody does. You don't change the world. You just make your own small, tiny contribution. And it ends up. It does end up. So, you know, that's the message I always try to make. I wrote a book called The Last Great Ape. And in that book, one of my biggest messages, the reason why I wrote it, about my adventures and understanding my path to activism, is because I do want to influence more people out there that have that feeling that they do want something to change, but it's hard for them to make the first step. And I'm trying to use my experience to tell anybody out there, just try. Not something big, not something huge. Just try to make one step and try to make one small difference, and you'll see how fulfilling it is. And how meaningful it is for you.
So I would like, in a couple minutes, I would like to talk about a recent victory with the arrest of the elephant traffickers, the ivory traffickers. But before then, I'm wondering if you can say just a little bit more about how you went from this idea of an organization to actually having the organization itself, and was it easy to find allies once you stepped in, or was that difficult? How was that process of moving from a person with a great idea and a chimpanzee attached to your chest to someone who is actually working with law enforcement? How did that transition happen?
Well, it was a hell of an adventure. But basically, it was a weird mix because I was a father and mother to a baby chimp. And at the same time, I was trying to look all serious and go to the government and try to talk about that and build the political framework for it. That was always a huge contradiction. I remember that, you know, future the baby, he would have nightmares at night because they do have memories of the killing of their families. So future would sleep on my chest at night with a diaper, and I would feel his eyes moving, shifting to the sides each time, and then he would jerk off. Then he would be just jumping and then trying to basically to get milk. But obviously with me, he cannot. So he would just try to suck my body and try to find comfort in that. And he would give me these hickeys many times. And I would go in the daytime to the ministry and try to look all respected and talk about opening an organization and have meetings, and I would have the sickies on me. And that was pretty embarrassing. And when I would try to explain this and saying I share my bed with a chimp, then that would definitely not be very helpful to try to build a credible kind of image. But basically, it wasn't easy. It was a big fight. There was great resistance to this idea, of course. There's corruption all around, and you were trying to basically shake things up. I basically had completely nothing. I had no money. I had, you know, we had no office and no car and no computers and no budget and no, basically nothing. I mean, all I had was an idea. And that was fantastic, because that filter was great to have nothing, because that meant that no one would be attracted to my orbit just because they thought they would have a job. So the only ones that would be in my orbit and come closer to me and try to understand what is going on and get closer would be people who would need something that is not money and not a job. And that was a great filter, because then the only guys who came closer would be people who need something else. Maybe need a sense of achievement. Maybe they would need, maybe from a sense of patriotism. Maybe from a need to show themselves that they can do something good beyond themselves. And so I started getting Cameroonians at that point. You know, I started in Cameroon. So that would have their own pure motives, simply because there's nothing else. The first, when we tried to apply it, it was equally crazy. You know, our first operations were completely violent. It went all directions. I didn't know what to expect. You know, there were many, many failures in the beginning, many risks, and basically the feeling that was that everyone was against us, the traffickers, the government, anyone out there, even the conservation community was against us. Everything was against this happening. So, but we pushed through, and we were persistent, and together with this group of local, I would say activists, we managed to make it happen. And after a few months, we managed to get, without money and without anything, we managed to, just a group of activists, managed to get the first ever wildlife prosecution in the whole of Central and West Africa, in the whole of basically forested Africa, where these apes live.
And has, before we get to the elephant question in a moment, this also seems, I mean, you're going against people with a lot of money involved, and so has this been dangerous for the people on the good side?
Yeah, look, 100%. I mean, we have that all along. We had that in the beginning, and we have it until now. We have, again, risks not just from the traffickers, but also from corrupt police officers, from corrupt wildlife officers. And we witness that, you know, all the time. We witness physical risks, political risks, legal risks. Definitely the machine is fighting back. So having threats like when I get out of jail, I'll kill you, is something trivial for us. That is not something that, you know, that's just a part of our work. And there were even some attempts of lives of some of the people. But we pushed through, you know. I'll give you an example from Gabon, one of our countries. One of the activists, a legal advisor, has been in an operation, in an arrest operation. He was trying to catch the traffickers. Traffickers were outside. The police officers tried to sabotage their own operation. And therefore, the legal advisors was left alone trying to chase a trafficker that ran away. And as he was doing that, the trafficker went around, moved around and shot him. And he was shot basically in his behind. And it was Christmas, and the guy was spending Christmas in a hospital, and he was interviewed on TV, and he was saying, I'm going to get better, and when I'm getting better, I'm going to find this trafficker that ran away, and I will put him back in jail, because the fact that he shot me only makes me a stronger activist and stronger in this fight. And you know what? That's basically what he has done a few months later. So here is an example of the risks and the kind of spirit of activism that we have in our community.
And so now let's jump to this recent success. Can you tell me about the recent arrest having to do with elephants?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I spent my Christmas in Ivory Coast, and where we were trailing a big criminal syndicate. I talked earlier about organized crime. Here is an example. This is a criminal syndicate that is connected to Vietnamese organized crime that has been installing in at least 7 countries that we know of. And again, they are doing many different criminal activities, and this is one of them. And they have installed in different countries. We started investigating that together with the U.S. authorities. But for a long time, they were not really advancing on these investigations. There are many seizures. You see the seizure of containers of ivory, but no one get arrested. And this specific syndicate was having a specific method of trafficking. This is how we know how much they are doing. And they were basically hollowing out wood. A piece of wood timber, and putting ivory inside, and then covering it with wax, and putting it in a container, and then exporting it illegally. And we look at the scope of this trafficking, this criminal syndicate, and we realize that this syndicate was active for a few years, and probably in charge of disseminating tens of thousands of elephants, because any of these containers were having 100, 200, 300 elephants every time a container goes. So they have their own empire and poachers they employed and their own methods. And we tried to attack it in one of the countries they installed in Ivory Coast, and wanted to try to find the heads there. And we had a few leads, and we were surveilling the major trafficker and collecting more information about him. And finally, with the Ivory Coast Authority and a special unit that is called UCT in Ivory Coast, we finally managed to arrest this one trafficker, this the person who was in charge of all of these operations, or at least the Ivory Coast station of this operation. I managed to get a lot of more information from him to try to take us to other countries and also assist in arrests in Asia. And after that, we managed to find more of his collaborators and his operations, and arrested another. So the first one arrested was a Vietnamese. We managed to arrest another Vietnamese, another Chinese, and some others were helping them. And in total, now 5 traffickers, an entire ring, trafficking ring out there with pangolin scales and with ivory and others. But what was interesting for people to understand of how criminal the ivory trade is and how much of an organized crime we're talking about, how mafia-like kind of activities, is that in this ring, we are basically now investigating and continue to investigate 6 different illegal activities. For example, they were carrying, we got to seize 4 illegal firearms, and there's one investigation on the small arms illegal trade and circulation. and how they got that. And we have another full investigation on their drugs activities. They basically wanted to have a farm of marijuana and other kind of drugs that they could export to Europe from Ivory Coast. And maybe one of the more, and they were connected to three different tax havens as they were doing money laundering. So there's a financial investigation going into all of these activities of money laundering. But maybe the more kind of shocking one for people and the more touching for me was that they were trafficking women for prostitution in China. So basically, they took girls from Ivory Coast and moved them with fake passports to China, where they're probably held and where the passports were probably taken from them, and they were held against their will to do prostitution in China. And we are currently trying to outreach to those victims, and we managed to find some of the victims, and we try to find and rescue some of those victims in China. So here is an example of a criminal wildlife syndicate and what it means and how our work means, because some people think about wildlife trafficking in terms of poaching and poachers. We don't deal with these levels. We deal with the level of the traffickers, the international traffickers that are actually managing this as a mafia, activating hundreds of poachers and disseminating not one or two elephants, but tens of thousands of elephants. And our main work is to try to locate and take down these families or these mafias in order to protect Africa's disappearing wildlife.
So thank you for all that. And we have about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes left. And we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. And one, I know this is a longer question, but how is the, now that you are gaining these successes, how is the local support for your work? Has that, are you having to fight a lot of the local people, or a lot of local people? Is it mixed? Is it, are they supportive? How does that run?
Well, when you say local people, you know, we are now as Eagle, as you mentioned in the beginning, we are a community of activists, and most of these activists are local activists. We work in 9 different countries where we have stable work, and we collaborate with many, many other countries across the world. But in each one of these countries, we are based on local activism, on people who are Africans that love their country, patriots. They want their country to be better. They want things to change, and they want to protect their own wildlife natural heritage. So when you talk about local people, first of all, what I see is our activism. All of this community is community of local people. If you're talking about the police forces, the wildlife forces, if you're talking about the bigger system, the fight still remains. It's a constant fight. And it's a fight against corruption at all different levels. And there's many backlashes. And I would say that in some of those cases, we had to fend off, in some of the cases where kingpins were concerned, we had to fend off ministers that were trying to get those traffickers released. Corruption goes up, and these are serious mafias. And so many times we have to arrest police officers and put them in jail. We have to get wildlife officials arrested and get them to jail, even high officials, whether it is a general or whether it is a colonel, an ex-minister, director of wildlife of his country. These are people that we had to put in jail. Obviously, these actions have backlashes. And so this fight, I would say, is a constant fight. It gets easier with time, mostly because our activists, the local activists, become stronger and more experienced, learning to expect some of these backlashes and learning to fight them in a higher higher level, but it's a constant fight.
Yeah, I'm sorry that with that last question I said it poorly, and you answered it great. I said it poorly because I wasn't meaning to imply that the activists are not local. It's like here, I've done a lot of activism against deforestation, and the activists who are fighting the deforestation, we're all local too, but the general population in a logging town will quite often end up hating us, even though we're all local as well. That's all I was getting at.
Well, look, it's I would say, if you look at the general public, first of all, the general public in these countries is not participating in this illegal trafficking. It's not a general issue of behavior. In fact, many of those traffickers are foreigners, and especially the bigger ones are foreigners. I would say that, look, I think it's mixed. I think that in many cases we have good examples of where the public was captivated by the spirit of those activists. But what it means, and many of them are charismatic and can express themselves well, and that has been the most successful. And I think the message that people were getting was not just about wildlife, but mainly about change. I'll give you an example. I was talking on a radio show in Cameroon many years back, and it was just before an election. The election was not free and fair at that time, and I was talking about that and corruption in NGOs and corruption in the nonprofit world, and all of a sudden somebody's calling, because it was a talk show where people call, and they call in, and somebody calls in and says, you know what, you need to put these guys who are fighting wildlife, put them on our elections to observe our elections, we'll have a real elections. The funny thing was that this was a state-run radio station, so the broadcaster was immediately turning off the phone and was just afraid that soldiers would come to take him, because definitely that was not a good thing for the president. But it was very telling. What it told was that people always underestimate the change they can do, and by doing that, the public showed that they made the connection. They realized that if change is possible in one point, at one sector, to one part of their lives, change is possible everywhere. You see, change is very catchy. Change is very dangerous in that way, because it shows the possibilities. It shows how easy it is to make a difference. And I think that is one of the things that were most fulfilling for me, understanding that one ripple of change can cause many other chain effects. One ripple can continue and create more and more change, not just in wildlife, not just in human rights, or not just in democracy. And that's for me the path of activism, and that's what it means.
So that would be a wonderful place to end, but I have one very, very, very quick question, which is how can people who do not live in Africa, most of the audience for this is going to be Europe, United States, Australia, how can they help you in your work, as well as doing work, as well as following your advice and doing the local work, how can they help you?
Well, I mean, first, my first answer for it is a more general one, in saying, well, you know what, you can make a difference anywhere. It doesn't have to be in Africa. It doesn't have to be specifically on this specific species. It can be anywhere, because you're all pissed off about something. Just cross that line from being pissed off to actually trying something, trying to make one step towards something, a small difference, and see how it works out. And that would help us, because that's what we are all about, in asking people to make those steps towards activism. The more narrow answer, I would say, well, look, you know, wherever you're at, open your eyes, try to look at it, go on the net, try to see if you would see anything being sold as ivory, anything being sold as a skin, a skull. Many of those animals are arriving through the illegal wildlife trade. And sometimes just small pieces of the picture, just one piece of ivory you've seen somewhere on a shop may connect us to far bigger criminal organizations that supply them. So we are relying many times on the public to investigate, take some time and dig into things. And many times we got tips from people who are just passionate and said, I just continued looking. I just realized that it exists and I just dug into and looked more on the web and looked on the internet and found something. And many times it leads to very big arrests. So that can also be of big help.
Well, thank you so much for your work. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Ophir Drouri. This is Derek Jensen from Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.